right, we're back in the book of Proverbs again this morning. Looking forward to finishing chapter 1, considering that today. If you remember, these first 9 chapters are a series of longer form lectures from the Father to the Son. It's about 10 lectures and 2 interludes. What we mean by interludes are simply breaks in the lecture series from the Father to Son. And the first one is this morning. So immediately after lecture 1 is interlude 1. So even before we get too comfortable in how the patterns of the lectures work, the Father introduces the third character to the story. Remember that we have 4 voices, leading voices in Proverbs, and there are 2 men and 2 women. The 2 men are the Father and then the sinner that we met last week, the leader of this gang. And then there's also Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly. And so we are introduced to Lady Wisdom this morning. She's the one that speaks, and that's why it's an interlude. It's not the Father's voice, but it's Lady Wisdom's voice. And so we read through that. But as we begin, I'd like to encourage you here that Lady Wisdom plays a crucial part in the story of Proverbs and in what Solomon's intending to do. So it is a bit unusual that we might begin reading this portion of the text, and we see in verses 20 and 21 that right away he identifies wisdom in a feminine way. So he hasn't done that yet. You know, he's just said that we need wisdom, and we established wisdom as the skill in living righteously, which we all need. We need the skill of living righteously. So now as we start in 20, Father introduces a new character. He says, wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open square. So here, beginning at this point in Proverbs, and then all throughout the book, we have this personification of wisdom. Why does Solomon do that? And what really is he doing? Personification, by definition, it's a poetic device whereby you give human characteristics to a non-human object or an idea. So is wisdom really a woman? No, wisdom is not really a woman. But there's significance as to the reason that Solomon portrays this immaterial idea of living well, of being skillful in God's design, that he presents that idea in a feminine way. So other examples, just to list a few of personification, would be something like the trees whispering or the stars dancing, the sun smiling. So those are from a few from Earth and sky, that we would do that. Does the sun really smile? Of course it doesn't. But we describe it that way, give it some human characteristics, and it communicates something to us. We do this about even our own body, like that our heart might leap or our stomach might sink. Those things aren't really happening, but they help communicate something in a more vivid way, perhaps put some color to the portrait. So as far as Proverbs is concerned, the skill of living righteously now takes a feminine form. And what she's doing throughout the whole book is she's walking and talking with people. Wisdom takes feet, and she interacts with young and old, with men and women, though primarily the communication in the book is that the women, the Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly, are both after the same young man that the Father's addressing. This assists us in visualizing his point. It encourages our imagination. It helps us to not perhaps think in such rigid forms, but to captivate our attention, particularly, and this is important in developing Proverbs, for the young men. What, as he's talking to a young, marriageable-aged young man, what might captivate his attention? Oh, well, there's this woman. She's wise. Here's Lady Wisdom. So he paints her for his son as an ideal to pursue, an ideal woman to pursue. And there's the equal opposite that we'll come across later. Lady Wisdom is bold. She is striking. She's mysterious. She's beautiful. She makes promises to the young man as well. And we'll hear her call to him today. So what we're going to do in the rest of our study in Proverbs is do the same thing that Solomon did and refer to wisdom as he intended, and that is to refer to wisdom as a woman. So keep in mind, for those of you people who are more poetic and you like the pictures, then lean into it and enjoy it. But remember that wisdom is the immaterial idea of living righteously, of actually doing life as God intended us to do life. So don't lose the idea for the image. And then those on the other side who are like, why are we still calling this thing a woman? Because it's not a woman, it's this idea. Well, lean into the imagery, because it's good for us. So don't constantly break down the imagery in your heart. Actually, sort of play the game along and let Solomon's imagery be impactful in your heart. So after this morning, we will have met 3/4 of the main voices. Lady Folly is the one that remains. As we start here, I also wanted to point out to you something that we're not going to be able to do all the time because we don't have time for it. And it's not as much the nature of a sermon as it would be the nature of Bible study. So there is parallelism everywhere in Hebrew poetry. It really is some of the building blocks of Hebrew poetry. So I wanted to show you a clear example of it and talk about it a little bit as we get going so that we just learn to see it, because we're not going to be able to point it out at every point along the way, or that's all we would be doing, is just pointing out that everything's parallel. What do we mean by parallel, or what's parallelism? It's repetition in Hebrew poetry. So we have a line that we'll just call it line A. And A is true. And then the line advances, or the second line advances. So you'd say, and what's more is that B is true. So here we have wisdom calling aloud outside. That is true. And then the second line, B, builds upon the same idea, restates the idea, but puts another shade to the picture. So she then raises her voice in the open square. What's different about the second one? Good question. That's part of the point. That's part of how the poetry works, is that is there something a little bit unique about the second line, or are they simply saying similar or the same things? So always, pairs of lines are connected to each other. B is connected to A, and it has something in common with it. So parallelism is identifying the point of correspondence between one thing and another. The nature of that correspondence might vary a little bit. It will vary. But in general, it involves some sort of repetition or substitution. So to put a couple categories of types of parallelism in your mind, I'll give you 3. And this is reducing significantly, but it gives us maybe a couple bowls to throw different kinds of parallelism into. So one would be synonymous parallelism. This is like repetition, very much like what we see on the screen. Okay, so you have wisdom said 4 times in 4 lines, an activity that's very similar, something about her voice projecting in all 4 lines, and then you have a space that is saying something about the openness of the square or the publicity of it in all 4 lines. So you can see Solomon's saying similar things in his introduction to her in these 4 lines. So that would be a synonymous or repetitious parallelism, shades of the same, but at times engaging the synonyms helps to present a fuller picture. Then other times we'll see something like a synthetic parallelism is what you could call it, and that would be an advancement of an idea. So that would be in line A, where you just make a simple statement, and then in line B, take it a step further. Like if you said, we went into the house had 8 rooms. You're like saying something, you're not saying the same thing as the first line, but you're still talking about the same idea in a continuing sort of a way. And then a third category to look for might be antithetic parallelism, and that's opposites. So a contrast, a sharp contrast. And we see this chapters 10 through 15 basically is all antithetic parallelism. So you'll just see this, but that. The wise this, but the fool this. And you paint opposite ideas. So those are a little bit overgeneralized, but they're helpful categories to look for, maybe saying nearly the same thing, saying an advancing idea, or saying an opposing idea. And even as we go this morning, it's pretty much the whole text. So enjoy looking for that as you study through Proverbs. So we have the character, and we have parallelism. The point of the parallelism here, we just alluded to, the Father's painting a picture. Wisdom hasn't talked yet. This is the introduction. This is like, here's someone about to come to the stage, and this is what she's doing, this is what she's about, before she starts talking. And his introduction to her is essentially that she's a she's loud, and she's adamant, and she's speaking very publicly. Those are the points that are present in this part of the text. The bustling streets is the scene in which she shows up. The busy marketplace, the open air, the main thoroughfares, points of funneling, almost like where everybody has to walk by, that's where she's at. And she's not just going to be sitting down in the corner, saying her little thing, holding up a sign, saying, well, if you want to stop by, I'm here. She's on the rooftops and she's yelling at people. And that could be, if you paint that picture in your mind, like you go downtown and there's a street preacher screaming. That's kind of the idea. And it might make people, even the people who agree with her, uncomfortable. I don't know if even as, you know, there's different perspectives on the right ways or in different ways to evangelize. But even if you're all in on the idea of evangelism, and even if you're all in on the method or on like the message, sometimes the method, like if you go downtown and somebody's screaming like hellfire and judgment, are you like, yeah, yeah, I agree, I'm with this guy? Or are you kind of like, well, I'll just be, I concur. Okay, that can exist where you're like, this isn't, it's an uncomfortable scene, but she's right and she's doing well. So lest we get the idea that Lady Wisdom is just sort of quietly moving around and her dress is just waving across the ground, and if you'd like to go and listen to her, you'll have a nice, quiet conversation. Like, she's yelling at everybody. She's like, boys, like, listen up. And everybody will listen up. It's the open street. So it's a bit, culturally speaking, too, a less common, if not inappropriate, image. Where, like, who's here? Who's in the chief concourses? Who's at the openings of the city gates? The city elders are at the city gates. The old dudes who lead the city are in the city gates. And here's Lady Wisdom saying, let me tell you how to live. Let me tell you how to be a king. I know. And if you'll listen to me, you live. And if you don't, you die. What's it going to be? So that's kind of the setup. And she hasn't even spoken yet. But that's how the dad presents her. That's how Solomon presents her, is really as this street preacher. The implications are that she and her message, that wisdom is available. And you have no excuse for not hearing wisdom. She's screaming outside. There are no prerequisites for embracing her message. And that, I think we know in our hearts, can be a turnoff to people who know things. They want there to be prerequisites. Right? They want there to be some sort of hidden knowledge or secret a way that they know and other people don't know. Or perhaps this could be a stumbling block for the well-educated in our society, is that you're telling me the guy who knows nothing can go and embrace the same message that I, the sophisticated one, would embrace? And to like humble yourself to this, like the kiddie pool, like everyone, like the babies can go in here. To humble yourself to that rather than this, you know, elaborate dive into the deep end. Takes a lot that most people will not humble themselves to. So she's available, no prerequisites. There's this free fullness to her message. There's Christianity is not, and Yahwehism, this covenantal relationship with God, is not found in the hidden places of the world. It's an open message that we would declare freely to all. So what does she say? She says, how long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? How long will scorners delight in their scorning? How long will fools hate knowledge? She is exasperated. She is frustrated. How long is this going to go on? It indicates that there's been a length of time, namely the entirety of the life of anyone walking by her, that she's been doing this. Many people repetitively every day have passed her and have ignored her, have tuned her out, have no reason to listen to her. She's repeated these things ad nauseum, and people aren't listening. And so her voice has grown louder, a little bit more desperate. And who is she talking to? Here's where we're going to pause, and these three categories of people represent three of four categories of people in Proverbs. Probably four types of young people as well. I mean, these young people grow into adults, so four types of adults. And on this spectrum of four people, we have on the far side, we have the wise. Okay, so there are wise people in Proverbs. Those are the young people who have heard Lady Wisdom's voice and tuned into it, cared about it, assimilated it, and are walking in her ways. Okay, so there's the wise youth. It's an unusual thing to find one of them, but when you do, you are impressed, and it's wonderful, and you're grateful that they're listening to Lady Wisdom. The other three are all categories on the other side of the equation. There's different degrees of folly on the left side. And to go all the way over, you have mockers or scorners. Those are the people, the third one's mentioned here. Or no, the second one's mentioned, excuse me, the scorners here that delight in their scorning. That's the fourth category. If you have wise over here, then on the opposite end of the spectrum, there's the scorner. This is the person who has not just taken a moderate response to wisdom's voice, but they hate wisdom's voice, and they want to tell everyone about it. They're the ones that are standing next to or opposite wisdom, and they're throwing mud at wisdom, or they're screaming how stupid wisdom is, or they're making these intellectual arguments against wisdom. That's this kind of a person. They're angry at the message. But we know not everyone is angry about the message of wisdom or of the Lord. Many people are, let's go one category in, these are the fools. And there's a number of words that refer to them throughout Proverbs, but that category of fool is that they have made a decision. They've decided against going down that path. Christianity, let's say, and we're making this leap consistently in verbiage just because that's where we're going to go. So Christianity is not for them, though they might think it's cool for the people who are in, might admire maybe the meaningfulness that it has, or even some of the products that it produces. It's like, well, you guys are good people. That's great. I'm happy for you. But it's not mine. I don't agree with wisdom. And at the end of the day, they're in the same large circle, the same category of rejectors. So that's a fool. And then you have in between the two, but always leaning left, always leaning toward folly, are the simple. And those are the ones that she primarily addresses here. It's the simple ones, and they love simplicity. And then here's just the general category of fools. How long, simple ones, will you love simplicity? Who is this? It's often the idea of simplicity, at least I grew up sort of thinking that the simple ones means simple-minded, or perhaps gullible, maybe a little thick, just kind of dumb, like not tracking with what the message is. And that's really not the point of simple here. Simple is someone who's undecided. They're listening. Their ears are open and open to all four voices. Yeah, Dad, I'm listening. Yeah, crazy uncle leader of the gang, I'm listening. Yeah, Lady Wisdom, I'm here. Lady Folly, I'm here. I'm open. An open-mindedness is the characteristic of this person. A lack of commitment to an idea, but rather willingness to hear any idea and to field any idea, to let it sort of just sit there. And we're waiting. We're waiting to see. I'm not sure yet. I'm undecided. She primarily addresses them. And it's interesting, isn't it, the things that she says about each of these categories? How long's undecided ones, will you love being undecided? There is a certain satisfaction, and I think we, this generation, perhaps more than any other, have seen this phenomenon, that there is a great delight that a large and increasing number of people take on being undecided. That's actually a virtue in our society. A lack of dogma is very attractive. We're like, well, I'm not trying to shove anything down your throat. I'm very willing to hear you. That's great that you believe that. And that's great that you believe that. I think there's sort of beauty or truth in all places. And I have my truth, but if it's not for you, that's okay. But this idea that we can't be for sure, therefore the skepticism is actually the safest place to live. To live in this gray, to live in this, okay, more voices, just intaking, not really being the one who's saying anything, but being the one who's asking everything. That's a leading characteristic, like a leading sort of caricature in our culture today. So wisdom addresses all of the ones who are walking by. It's interesting that this is really written for the son to be wise. And the ones who believe, really, that she's talking to the other three categories are the wise ones. So it's addressed to the fools who aren't listening for the wise who are, because the fools won't. Her accusation reveals a few things concerning their affection. Again, that the uncommitted love being uncommitted, and that the mocker delights in, he adores mocking. And then the third one, that the fool, and those are the same words, by the way, simple, simplicity, scorner, scorning. So a good translation there representing that. And then it's not that the fools hate folly. That's what you'd expect. So here's another just Hebrew poetry sort of ism, that the last one, there's a turn, and it may signify the end of that little piece of information in the text, but the fool doesn't love folly, though they do. She's communicating something different, that to love simplicity, to delight in scorning, is to hate knowledge. That's what the scoffer, or the simple one, does not believe. They believe they can do both. That I don't hate knowledge, I'm just open to the idea of folly. No. If you're open to folly, you hate knowledge. To love one is to hate the other. And that's true throughout the whole book. You're in one or the other camp. One or the other of these things categorizes and qualifies you or describes you. So how long is this going to keep taking place? It's interesting, too, that the path of this broad path, it does offer delights along the way. There can be a tendency, I think, for us to have this perspective that those uncommitted or those against Christ, that really their lives are miserable, ultimately. Like if they were to tell you the super truth, if they were to be completely vulnerable, they would say, no, my life is wrong. It's a sham. I don't enjoy my life. But that's not necessarily true. And that's one of the very deceptive things about folly, is that folly does promise fullness. Folly does promise delights along the way, and there can often be an experience of those moments along the way. Is it eternally? Is it truly? Is it enduringly satisfying? No. So somebody like Lewis would say it's not real, but it is experienced. It is. There are goodnesses, deceptive goodnesses along the way. Isn't it true that fool's gold still shines and it still deceives and it still offers delight? And the younger you are, probably the more prone you are to be tricked by it. So after this address, wisdom makes a conditional promise. That's verse 23. She's really calling for one thing and one thing only in this text. It's that they would turn, so they would listen. So the rebuke is all the things she's been saying, this call to skilled righteousness. Turn, listen. Goes back to the marketplace imagery where basically nobody's even looking. Nobody's paying attention. They're just going about on their way. And I would encourage this like circle, underline, highlight, turn, because it's going to come up later in the text too. But you turn at my rebuke, and if you would just listen to me, if you would just lend me your ear, I'm going to pour myself out towards you. I'm different than you think I am. I'm not just some crazy lady screaming in the streets. I have something that you need. So is the Spirit here? I'll pour out my Spirit on you. I think a natural question might be if you're reading through it this week, if you've been putting a little thought into this, like, what, is this talking about the Holy Spirit or like a different Spirit? If it's the Holy Spirit, it would be the only explicit mention in Proverbs. It's nice to think of it as the Spirit, but I don't think that's what he's really talking about. He's talking about the Ruach, or the Spirit of this personification, the personification of wisdom's Spirit. And what he's really saying then is that if you, well, and one more thing, the parallelism helps too, because these are parallel lines. So I will pour out my Spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. So the Spirit and the words, like the message, the wisdom really is the point. So if you'd stop running around the market and ignore me, if you'd pause and turn to me and you'd give me your heart but for a moment to hear wisdom, then I'll make myself known to you. Yes, you will receive me. You will become wise. You'll enter a new world, a world of refreshment, a world of illumination, a world of life, a world where you've heard wisdom and you're living according to it. You can see clearly for the first time. It's like all of these people are walking around the marketplace and the sun's off. They're just walking around in darkness. And if you'd listen to that voice that's screaming at you, then the light turns on. It doesn't necessarily change what's going on around you, but it certainly changes your ability to interact with it in a wise way. And so she says, I'm yours. If you turn, listen, pay attention. Then there's two warnings. And they're pretty strong. She blames them for what's going to happen to them if they don't listen. So here's the idea. Because I did this and you did that. Because I called, I sat on the street and screamed at you, you refused. Because I extended my hand to you, and what did you do? Slap it away constantly. Because of that, because I counseled you and you disdained it, you spat upon it, you hated it, you loved other things, therefore you hated my voice, you would have none of it. Because that's true, and because what I have been saying is true, that there will be this sort of day of reckoning, there is calamity. When calamity strikes you, and it will, I will laugh at you. I will say I told you so. I will rub it in your face. How will she do that? By not being there. On the day when the earthquake strikes Jerusalem and all of these people are running around, where's that lady? Where's that lady? And they run to the corner that she sat for year after year after year after year, and she's just not there. Where is she? She's gone. She cried out for years and years and you didn't want her. And ultimately, I don't think that now they want her. They just know that they needed her. They still love what they love. I will laugh at your calamities. No, I mean, the parallelism all through here. I will mock when your terror comes. And then she describes that in 27. Like a storm, your terror shows up like this windstorm or a thunderstorm, and your destruction comes like a whirlwind. Everything is destroyed. Your life is strewn apart. And ultimately, she's talking about death here. There's more leading to it. There are things that lead to death. There might be actual days where it's just everything is devastated, a bit like the Job situation. But ultimately, here she's talking about their death. And when they die, when destruction strikes, that's it. Is what she's saying. There is no purgatory. There is no second chance. There is no calling out because there were 1,000 second chances yesterday. Distress and anguish will arrive. Then they call on her. She's not there. I won't answer. They will seek her diligently. They will really go try to find her, but they will not find her. What do you think of that idea? How do you respond to that idea that wisdom will laugh? Wisdom will mock. It's a bit strong, isn't it? And some might say, I don't know if that's really appropriate, you know, for someone to laugh at you just because they were right all along. And though wisdom, we'll talk about this down the road, the identity of wisdom, if wisdom represents maybe one of the divine persons or not, how that all works, we'll get to in another of her interludes. But we know throughout other portions of Scripture that there are times explicitly that God laughs too. God laughs in judgment. And that's strong, right? We have this personification of wisdom laughing, and that's one thing, that's poetry. But that God laughs too, like in Psalm chapter 2. In Psalm chapter 2, it's an indictment against the kings of the earth and how they haven't bowed the knee to their king. And there will come a day that God will laugh at them. He who sits in the heavens will laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. He's doing the same things that wisdom's doing here. That's an uncomfortable I told you so. God does not take delight in the death of the wicked. He does not take delight in eternal hell. But he does not hold back from it either. And he said, as we think about just New Testament, how it paints the picture of the judge, there is a certain satisfaction and vindication in both Old and New Testaments of God the judge, that this is right and this is the good end, because to not have this end is unjust. To not have this end is incorrect from true justice's standpoint. And you have pictures like the martyrs in Revelation who are crying out, how long? In a different way than Lady Wisdom is, but same idea. How long is God going to wait to judge? Because they've been slain for his name. And there's a good day of judgment. It's dark, and it's ugly, and the day of the Lord is something that in the Old Testament, the saints were encouraged to not be super gleeful about or to rejoice in, but to be sober about. We were serious about, but God being satisfied in judgment is not unjust. It is good. If he weren't, then something's wrong. It is good for us to see evil addressed, truly. So, address it. There's a bit of the Noah's Ark image here, that Noah's preaching and preaching and preaching, and he's calling out, he's building the boat, and what do people do? Well, there's probably some simple people and some fools and some mockers, all maybe some that sit around and are like, that's interesting, maybe I will go in that boat. I don't know, Noah's an interesting guy. And others that are like, no, just ignore him. And others that probably laugh and jeer and sit in scorn of him. But ultimately, the door closes. And whoever's in is in. And the door's shut. And that's it. That's what the poem's communicating, that there's a moment of the door shutting, that the long-suffering of God, which is for salvation, stops, and mercy's over, and there will be judgment. People will cry on that day, you know, have we not done many wonderful things in your name? Or they might cry, today's the day of salvation, I know you were right all along, and he will say, depart from me, I never knew you, you workers of iniquity. So it's serious, and that's the warning. Then she repeats a similar idea, but a little bit different end. Because they hated knowledge, because they didn't choose the fear of the Lord. That's key, isn't it? That the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We've talked about that. That is, this fear of the Lord as intended is right relationship with him. It is a filial response to his fathering of us, that he has been generous to us. He's a good and kind king, a good and kind father. And he views us very generously. They didn't want that. They didn't want to walk into this, you know, zero entrance pool. They didn't choose the fear of the Lord. They would have none of the counsel. They despised every rebuke because of that. So both cases, it lands the responsibility very firmly upon the one who didn't listen. It's their responsibility to have heard. Because of those things, they are going to eat the fruit of their way. They've planted seeds. They've lived life. And now it's time to reap the harvest and to eat the fruit of what you planted. That is frightening. It is frightening for anyone that's outside of Christ And for those inside of Christ, it's important that we take this, like that initial, like, oh boy, what did I plant? What did I plant? And we don't do that, that we don't consider all the things we've done and be like, am I going to reap a good reward? But instead, we look to the cross of Christ as the one who planted every good seed and will reap every good harvest, the one who fulfilled all righteousness. That's why he, the good sower and the good reaper, that's the one that we're hoping in and trusting in. But he says, you're going to eat the fruit of your way. You hated, you rejected, you had none of it, you despised it. You've stuffed your face with the love of lesser things. So now you'll experience the effects of such a life. It's time to reap what you've sown. Strong warnings, aren't they? And it ends with a prophecy. So this street preacher, this feminine street preacher introduced, then an initial call, two warnings, and now a conclusion, a prophecy. Here's what's going to happen. Two paths, two categories. This is the way of Proverbs. This is the way of life. The turning away, there you have it again. There's the inclusio. All right, what did she call for them to do? Turn. What have they done instead? Looked away, turned away. They turned the wrong direction. They lived the wrong life. And that is going to kill them. One scholar said it this way, the delusive security of fools is suicidal. They thought they were living well. They thought they had true delights. They didn't think they needed the voice of wisdom. And then they realized, that's the only thing that I needed. And instead, much like last week, you remember these objects, the teaching adorns, the teaching sort of gives life, it nourishes, it shows honor and blessing. And then on the other side of things, the greed poisoned, the greed was a trap, the greed killed. And here the same thing is happening. The turning away, the rejection, the not listening was a knife. And it destroyed them. Isn't it interesting that turning away and complacency, right, we're working on parallelism here. So turning away and complacency are parallel. We think about those two a little bit differently. And they do paint two unique ideas. Turning away, we think of like, yeah, that was a wrong action. You did the wrong thing. Complacency, that's a little different, isn't it? That's just not doing the right thing. That's just waiting too long. And so that's a strong argument for the idea that the one who dies in the simple category dies a fool. You never fall on the other side of the fence. You never lean towards wisdom in not being committed. So complacency will destroy you as much as turning away will. But here's the opposite idea. The path of peace, the path of safety, the path of fearlessness. Isn't that interesting? Already we can see in Proverbs the fear pitted multiple ways. Fear of the Lord and fear of evil. Those are two different things. The foolish person does have this and doesn't have this. And the inverse is true, that the righteous person does have the fear of the Lord and doesn't have the fear of evil. So right and wrong kinds of fear already in interlude one. So whoever listens, whoever obeyed, whoever turns, whoever repents, whoever believes, whoever hears the voice and responds to it, there is safety and security and confidence on that path. Now, here's where already the question's raised, and we're not going to address it at length, but here's where the question already is raised. Does Proverbs promise too much? Is Proverbs saying that if you obey God, then your life is totally safe and totally secure, and nothing evil will happen to you? That's not the point of his painting. He's painting a picture of the last day. He's painting a picture in this situation of the final destruction. Of the destruction that happens to the fool, of that day, the day when there's no more hope, the day when there's no more chances, the day when there's no more opportunity, when long-suffering and mercy are up, that day, the fool will cry and will eat the fruit of their way. They will die. That day, the wise will be safe and secure and without fear of evil. And those two things do, in a lesser way, qualify the path of life now. There are implications. It's like a stream, a river that flows down. Those are true things of our life, too. You could read a psalm like Psalm 91. There are big promises about what God will do, the security and protection, and how we should pray in that regard. But there is an eventual and an ultimate promise that's being fulfilled here, an eternal promise of the lack of destruction and safety. And so it's interesting in this text, like you think, we think very often about the final judgment being a judgment of deeds. And that's true, there are things that are written down, but even one deed against the law makes you a lawbreaker. But here in this text, it's less really about the deeds. He's not condemning the fools for what they did. It's not like the last lecture. It's not like the lecture where he's saying, don't go with that guy whose feet are running towards evil on the path. He's condemning them for an attitude, for a disposition, for unbelief, for lack of listening, for not moving toward God in repentance and faith. That kills people eternally. And that's significant. It means that one of the foundational points of Proverbs, right here in chapter 1, is that if we are to live, we must go to God. If we don't go to God, we die. And so there's a call toward everyone, and particularly to the young, who think perhaps they have a long life ahead of them, who think perhaps that there will be many more days to sit and listen to Lady Wisdom, many more days to weigh what might be the right path for them. And he's saying, stop weighing today. Don't pit all these ideas against each other and think and measure and determine and say, well, maybe tomorrow I'll come back and hear some more. We can do that while we're on the path of wisdom. Let's do that while we agree to it. It's not that we don't think through things. It's not that the path is just close your eyes and blindly follow me. He's not saying that. But he is saying, don't wait to leap. Leap now. Commit to wisdom, simple ones, ones who are still measuring, still thinking this voice, this voice, this voice, this voice. I'm sort of creating this like my theological cocktail here. So don't do that. Here it is, distilled for you already. This is the path of Yahweh. This is the way of the sages. It's been tested. It's been eternally given from the voice of God. Drink this and live. Or wait. And hang over a vast chasm on the bridge of God's long-suffering. That works as long as God is long-suffering. And there will be a day that the bridge is gone. So the day to move is today. So as we think about this from an explicit gospel perspective, and again, I don't know if these thoughts are already in your mind or not, but I'm waiting to identify kind of Lady Wisdom to have that conversation about who, if she represents one of the persons of the Trinity. So I'm not saying that Lady Wisdom's Jesus, but I am saying that there are similarities here that we also have, in the New Testament, we have someone who has cried out publicly, someone who knows the path to life. Yea, he is the path to life. And he said, if you're with me, then you are drinking the everlasting drink. If you are not with me, then you will be condemned. If you have embraced me, if you follow me and you are my disciple, then I lead the way to life. I've conquered death. I died for you. Now I live for you. I'll give you my resurrection. That's our hope. That's our confidence. If people will listen and listen and listen and listen to Jesus or hear him, if they walk by him, having heard this message time and time again, and they don't turn their ear and they don't stop to listen, there will be an eternal day that dawns, and it will be a day of destruction and despair and tears and finality. That will not be the day of opportunity anymore. And so the call at the end of the gospel, at the end of Jesus lived and died for you, he substituted himself for your sin. He's resolving the greatest problem that you have. And he's offering you a greater gift than you deserve. The end of that message is the same as the end of this message. And that is, how long, O uncommitted ones, will you love being uncommitted? How long, mockers, ridiculers of the faith, will you adore your ridicule? How long, fools, will you hate the knowledge of God? I don't hate the knowledge of God. Yes, you do. To varying degrees, but it's one category. And so the call is to humility and to a genuine response that says, I am the sinner. I have played the fool. That is who I was. And the only way to life is the way, the truth, and the life. That is the person and the work of Jesus. I ask him for new life. I believe his message. I'm with him. I'm resting my life completely upon him. And I'm moving. I'm not sitting on the bridge any longer. I'm not sitting on the shore apart from him. I'm actually moving towards him and resting in him to take me across the river of death securely, safely, so that I don't have to fear even my own people. So this is the call. Wisdom's cry is for us to be wise and live in righteousness after Christ.